Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Throughout his career, Gordon Parks explored many issues, including segregation, feminism, and nationhood, through writing, photography, and film. Much of Parks' early photographic output came through his affiliation with government programs, like the Works Progress Administration and the Office of War Information. At the John Womerding Symposium on American Art, American Communities, Then and Now, held on February 8, 2019, art historians Melanie C. Harvey, Kelly Jones, Richard J. Powell, and Laura Wexler discussed Parks' work for the government and how his photographs participated in a larger social conversation. This panel discussion is moderated by Anjali Leibowitz.
These were just fantastic. Thank you so, so much. I have a million questions for you, but I really would, I think we covered so many different topics, and I wonder what kinds of questions you might have for each other first.
I'll start. It's not a question, but it's kind of a, I was thinking about this, that we've, geographically, we've moved between Washington, D.C. and Harlem and Chicago, and I just find this mapping of both Gordon Parks' life and our respective projects really interesting, and it says a lot about kind of the power of visual culture and African American art in particular. Its movements in these interwar years and also the post-war years, that these three locations are really, really kind of key to a kind of an imagining, a reimagining of blackness.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, something I thought about with a lot of your papers is how the Great Migration really is this grand force. I mean, Richard Wright says it the best, right? The new tide, which is where the title comes from, but that you have Parks moving from Kansas to Minneapolis to Chicago to D.C. and then New York, and how he has to navigate. I think, Melanie, you said it really well, of sort of a cultural insider, but a geographic outsider coming to the city and not knowing that being assigned to go eat at a lunch counter was the sort of not the best way to spend a day for him. Could you say a little bit more about that turn of phrase you used?
Sure. And I was really, of course, thinking more about the insider-outsider, a paradigm that Patricia Hill Collins uses in terms of feminism, and thinking, can we translate that, kind of alter it, adapt it to think about photographic practice? So it really becomes clear when you compare him photographing sites and spaces and different individuals that he does have a distance. And it begs a lot of questions about his relationship to Howard University. Now, I do know he mentions he wanted to have an exhibition there, but it does, you know, beg a lot of questions. This is also before D.C.'s first black art gallery, Barnett Aiden, which is founded in 1947. So I think it also is a very interesting way to think about also artist relationships. I mean, who did Gordon Parks call anyone before he came here to live, right? To think about what that landscape would have been like. And so I think those are the art histories I hope that we get to uncover further.
Yeah, that's great. Any other thoughts from panel?
I will ask Melanie, I love your, the way you went in deeply into the kind of photographic and spiritual histories of Washington, D.C., and I wonder if that is a larger project that you're working on, because I'm always interested in all these places, right? And, you know, American art history mostly being, or U.S. art history mostly being written about New York. Now L.A. is coming in, Chicago is coming in, and I think Washington, D.C., especially when you start to think about the role of African American artists or African Americans in the city in general, and then African-American artists and Barnett Aiden and Howard University Art Gallery are so important. So I'm just wondering if you're going to drill down on that history at some point.
Yes, thank you for that amazing kind of setup question. It is part of a larger book project where I'll be looking at AME visual culture, and that's African Methodist Episcopal visual culture, across printmaking, painting, as well as photography. And I'm hoping that that will be a kind of methodological approach that we can apply to Catholic Black churches, to a range of even, you know, sororities and fraternities, to think about how within their own networks did they influence aesthetic practice. So I'm hoping to participate in this kind of aesthetic mapping that we're doing and rethinking and decentering some of the spaces we think about in terms of Black art.
Yeah, and I was thinking about telling stories, read to me. And Robin Cost-Lewis's extraordinary keynote essay and the story that Parks told us and what I'm trying to uncover as the story of this transformation that this man had to make. I was wondering, it's really a question for Robin Cost-Lewis, whether the Black women in his work and the other work that we saw are on the ship. Mm. I don't know whether that question can be answered, but where are they in relation to the ship?
You mean Charles White's and Gordon Parks's photographs?
Yeah. Yeah, it's their whole. They're not fragments. In fact, they're
But I think they're responding to what Robin absolutely says.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think when I started, you know, my interest in Charles White and women, in my book South of Pico, which is about the 60s and 70s, and seeing White go to California, and then there's just a little bit that I write about the 40s, and, you know, he's like, gee, he's with Catlett, he's with, you know, which usually people don't talk about, mm-hmm. thanks to people like Rick Powell, who've done amazing work on Catlett. You know, these women come in, just briefly, mm-hmm. and I said, wait a minute, I want to look at that, and then you look at it, and it's like this, like you're saying. Thousands of years, all of a sudden you see all these women and you see all these activists, many of them, you know, related or working with Communist Party USA. And they're straight activists and they're journalists and they're doing all this heavy work. And these are his friends, these are his collectors. So then you go back to, oh, White was showing the beauty of the Black woman. Yeah. And it's so, so much more than that. Mm-hmm. It's beauty that is both physical, but it's also the beauty of the activist body, people making change. Mm-hmm. So it just becomes a whole other story from the kind of fragment, as Robin says.
Well, something I was wondering too in relationship to Charles White and that turn to women at mid-century, how do images create these kinds of communities? How Laura Wexler talked about the turn towards a national community, the need for Parks to sort of be this bridge from what we're terming sort of monolithically a Black community to the rest of the country because they need Black buy-in into World War II. And so how do images, say, in the crisis, in publications, in the Black press, how does that start to take people out of these localities that we've also talked about and to create more of a national Black community and thinking about how to move into the 1950s and 60s movements that we know so well?
Well, this is a key point that you raise, and I was thinking about this, reflecting on that image that Professor Harvey showed from Ebony Magazine, and people sometimes forget, we forget in the early 21st century that Ebony is created in 1945, and so it's not always been with us, and prior to that were publications like The Crisis. And opportunity, and even with a publication like that, that was a publication that was primarily for intellectuals and for people, race men and race women. I'm saying all this to say that images in the early to mid 20th century were a kind of a commodity. They were special, And particularly images of Black people were like extraordinary. That's why, you know, when these exhibitions took place in Harlem and Chicago and Washington, D.C., people were kind of mesmerized because this idea of representing Black culture visually in painting and sculpture, even in photography, was not something that was that commonly engaged with. It took a kind of a cultural cognoscenti to kind of to connect to these things. So pioneers like Gordon Parks, you know, who are trafficking in the world of image making and image creating and then distributing those in a journalistic context as well as art context. I mean, this was special. So I guess, I don't know if that answered your question, but I was just kind of thinking about while for us, we are inundated with images, this is a moment when these images, particularly Black images, were just kind of special and rare.
And to build on that point, I've been looking for images, visual representations included in the AME Church's, a newspaper organ, the Christian Recorder, which was prevalent during the late 19th century, and there just is an absence. And that's why that encyclopedia of African Methodism, where you're visualizing literally hundreds of years of religious history becomes important, because it sets a context for the intervention that Parks makes.
Okay, any other thoughts on this? I might open it up to the audience if that's okay. Does anyone have any questions? Please, there are two mics on either side, as you might remember from earlier. Any questions for the panelists?
Hi, my name is Joe Young. And I have a question about the Black community's response, particularly in NAACP, the Urban Leagues, to Richard Wright's Native Son and Gordon Parks' First Piece for Life about the Chicago gang and its emphasis on the gang leader named Red, as well as someone mentioned how the FSA needed Parks. Was he needed by Life magazine and others as well? Anyone address those questions?
I would start that, but I would say, use the microphone. I would say yes, although Life didn't have to recognize that it needed him. I think the FSA and the OWI did have to recognize that they needed him. It seems like, and from the wonderful essays in the catalog, in which it's really traced how closely the Rosenwald Fund and the FSA worked together to get him to Washington, and how intensely Stryker trained him. I mean, we get the story, but we get it fragmented in lots of places. It's been put back together with the documents in the catalog. We get the story that he walked into the FSA, he met Stryker. Stryker said, look, leave your camera and go walk around Washington, you know, get some lunch, you need a coat, get a coat, you know, you can take some time, go see a movie, come back and we'll talk. And he is badly treated in every place, and he recognizes that Washington, D.C. is an intensely segregated and violent place, and he comes back furious to Stryker. And he says, give me my camera. And Stryker says, no, you're not ready. You noticed something, but now how are you actually going to express this? And he spends weeks reading and talking with Stryker until he begins to develop an analysis of how to express this. That's the story that we get. We don't get so much the backstory of Stryker understanding that he needs someone. They went out, Delano met him in Chicago. They went out, they found him. They nurtured him, they invited him, and he responded. And it's a really interesting moment that we need to know more about. So I think the FSA moving into the war and the Office of War Information did know that it needed Gordon Parks, and him specifically, because he was brilliantly talented, and that's what they saw, and able to learn this and do this. Whether life, the history of life, is, again, very tied into the war and the time-life apparatus and all of that. I'm not a scholar of the History of Life magazine. So maybe some people here are. I think it's probably less urgent, but more interesting that life did that. But that's a guess. I actually don't know.
I would actually put it in the context of these baby steps in that direction. So you have, I think, in the exhibition, the wonderful exhibition, with the American Gothic Gordon Parks on the label, there's a picture of, or a little reproduction of, the Jacob Lawrence, part of his migration series of the woman with the mop, similar kind of image. And we can think of Jacob Lawrence and the Coast Guard, right, as the one kind of PR painter of this time, right? Or you can think of this show at the Museum of Modern Art, also in the 40s, of Hampton University art students. The one, you know, one of the two shows in the early, let's see, in the kind of around wartime, or before the 50s, say, by the Museum of Modern Art, that features African Americans. So I think these like little steps, and we can also think of the African American exhibitions that take place in Baltimore and New York and the Downtown Gallery, not New York, Baltimore Museum of Art, Newark Museum, and the Downtown Gallery in New York. So I think this is all the wider context. But it is the kind of baby step to integration, the kind of baby step that one will be enough, you know. So I would hazard to say, and like Laura, I am not a scholar of Life magazine, that's part of that same kind of trajectory where you see this one is going to be enough type of thing, and we're going to let you photograph, in that instance, the gangs, black gangs in Harlem.
And your question also encompassed the NAACP. Mm. And this is this is another book for somebody to deal with. Their relationship to visual culture, their relationship to positive images, the challenges that they faced as an organization and an institution that was dedicated to uplifting African Americans, and the difficulties that posed for them when artists decided to not be a part of a political project, but to do something more artistic, or to do something that might address problems, in like the gang images that Gordon Parks takes in the 1950s. I'm thinking about Du Bois' famous line, this art is nothing for me if it's not propagandistic. And that didn't necessarily work with a lot of the artists that were creating during this time period. I know from Motley, that was not his thing. He was going to do things that were rather provocative and outrageous in his own creative way. And I can imagine that with Gordon Parks, there was a desire, on one hand, to be a documenter of black life, and at the same time, not to be afraid to move into territories visually that might cause some consternation with people who want to just put up something that's comfortable.
Any other questions? I think we have time for one or two more. Oh, hi.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the National Gallery of Art, because I'm a Washingtonian, that is now starting to reach higher levels of inclusion. And I kind of feel Ruth Fine is in the room, because it was when she brought Wamira Bearden to the National Gallery as the first exhibit of an African-American artist who was receiving here at the National Gallery the kind of recognition that we're seeing contemporarily with the rise of interest in African Americans, period, and the African American artist in particular. So the panel gathered, as well as the original opening keynote, we're hearing, because I am an educator, that it's children and students and the future of America that is also an overarching concern of mine. I've been involved as a museum educator with the National Gallery, and I'm wondering if students are being incorporated into this very seminal exhibit, as well as in the future of planning for museum education. So my question is whether or not the education department here is working along with the art historical gallery component to bring students coming to Washington, D.C., to the National Gallery.
Should I answer that? Do you want to answer it, Phil? The education department has been extremely active. So the short answer is yes. The education department has been extremely active in the exhibition and the galleries. They bring school children in, I want to say, daily. the response has been really incredible. Unfortunately, due to the shutdown, one of the victims was a community day that was supposed to happen tomorrow, in which children are going to be given cameras, they're going to learn about Gordon Parks. There's really a lot of there was really a lot of activity around this, and I think it was because of the compelling nature of his photographs and how much they speak. And also, one of the things I noticed from Philip's checklist and when I walked through the galleries, there are so many pictures of children. Mm-hmm. Parks seemed to have a really he endowed them with so much dignity when he photographed them. He takes these low angles and he monumentalizes the children that you see. And I find it to be so touching. And you see that in children. Philip and I had a class in the study room and they really respond to those particular images. So yes, the education department is absolutely involved with working in this exhibition.
And representing Howard University, I know the NGA has been amazing in reaching out to our students. I think the culture and art editor for the Howard University Hilltop is here. So Howard University has really gleaned a lot from having access to this body of knowledge.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Oh, all right, time is up. So thank you so much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.